The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just than it will be, more compassionate. This is what we do each week. We talk about how, not merely as individuals, but how do we do it as groups, as society, make our world more just and more compassionate. And we do it through the prism of our Catholic values, our Catholic beliefs. The foremost of one is the dignity of the human person. And because each person, we believe, is made in the image and likeness of God, we believe, therefore, that each person has some fundamental human rights, and that as a society, we should try to make sure that those human rights are able to be exercised. And, you know, there's a whole litany of them. Interestingly, you know, probably the clearest articulation of them is in the 1948 Declaration of the Charter of the United Nations. But those rights are pretty much the same ones, not perfectly, because we got a little bit of difference on some issues, that are articulated in the letter that Pope John the 23rd wrote in the early 1960s about peace on earth. And he basically kind of talked about the same list of human rights that are in the Charter of the United Nations. And so those human rights are ordinary things. I mean, we take them almost for granted for most people. But we also know that a lot of people in the world don't have them. For example, the right to food, to a decent meal, to decent housing, to participation in the political process. Now, fortunately, in many parts of the world, those rights are exercised. But unfortunately, in far too many places, for millions upon millions of our brothers and sisters, those rights are not able to be exercised. So what we do each week is we talk about a variety of issues. We talk about issues that affect the common good. And the common good, if it were perfectly good, would be a place in which every single human right were able to be exercised and that we all acted responsibly to ensure that that was the case. Well, that's a little bit longer than I usually do in the beginning, but I wanted to just kind of lay out for our listeners why we do this. And we do it this week, you know, again, very new into the administration of President Trump, only a few weeks or so. And already there is a lot going on in the public square. There's a lot going on in the public square in which people with divergent points of view on what creates the common good have been out there raising their voice and, quite frankly, raising their voice in protest for some of the things that they think are not good in the common good, not good what's going on today, and therefore they would like to see some changes. So that's what we're doing this day. And today we're going to speak about a number of those things. We're going to speak about the situation of the recent executive orders affecting immigrants and refugees. And I mean, I've already spoken about them, and they are really incredibly troubling, those executive orders, from the perspective of our Catholic beliefs in the dignity of the human person and the broad-based bans that they include on nationality, on religion. It really is a very, very troubling thing to us. So we're going to speak about that with a guest in just a moment, Jody Zeisma, who is an attorney with Catholic Charities who has been involved in trying to make sure that some of those human rights are protected. And then a little bit later on in the show, we're going to speak with Kristen Hawkins, who actually, and this is kind of what I wanted to make sure we had a guest on, who marched in the Women's March and in the Pro-Life March. She marched in both of them because she did not see any conflict between marching for life and marching for women's rights. Now, obviously, a lot of people do see a difference there, but I wanted to have somebody like Kristen Hawkins on our show because there is a consistency to our belief in the dignity of a human person that we believe begins from the moment of conception, goes to human death. And so I think we're going to have an interesting show today, and we're going to talk about issues that are really center stage in the life of these great United States, but in a way that is, to some extent at the moment, tearing us pretty apart because of how awfully some of them are being played out. So, listen, I've spoken for enough for now. So let me go to our first guest. Our first guest is Jody Zisma, who is a supervising attorney for us at Catholic Charities, and we're delighted that she's working with us. And the past weekend, some of her staff and she, for a certain time, was out at JFK International Airport in being with some of the families whose people were detained, who didn't know what was happening with their loved ones who were coming from some of those countries in which there was a ban. Jody, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jody, before we get into some of the specifics of what's going on, which is so disturbing and troubling, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. How did you get to be these days one of our supervising attorneys? Where'd you kind of begin, and where'd you hang out, and how'd you get here?
Well, I've been with Catholic Charities for 8 years, or almost 8 years now. Prior to that, I actually have a master's degree from the Fletcher School at Tufts University in international law, and a lot of the issues that resonate with immigration are reflected in international law. So that's really my background. I've worked for immigrant and refugee rights even prior to going to law school. I worked for the Heartland Alliance in Chicago, doing refugee resettlement and working with asylum seekers.
Now, Tufts University is up in Massachusetts?
That's correct, in Boston.
So you've moved up in the world from Chicago to Massachusetts, now to New York.
I'm very happy to be in New York, yes.
That is great. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Wisconsin.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm from a suburb of Madison, Wisconsin. I have family, mostly German and Russian immigrants who settled in Kenosha and still live there.
Okay. Oh, well, that's great. We're glad you came here. We do have a little bit of a skepticism on our show for people who hang out for a while in Massachusetts, because we kind of think that some of them periodically wind up being Boston Red Sox fans.
Oh, not the case.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, Jody, being a Boston Red Sox fan is not a protected class. So we do discriminate in hiring at Catholic Charities of New York against Boston Red Sox fans.
So, I completely understand.
Right. It's a good thing to. Now, you know, I have to say, this is just me speaking. I don't have quite the same feeling about the New England Patriots as I do about the Boston Red Sox. But make no mistake about it, I'm rooting for Atlanta in the Super Bowl. So, I mean, just, you know, it's not that visual, but let's just say there are a few well-known personages associated with the New England Patriots who are not my favorite people in the world. So,
well, I'm a Green Bay Packers fan all the way.
I like the Green Bay Packers. I was rooting for Aaron Rodgers.
Good.
He's good.
He is good.
But anyway, okay, Jody, give our listeners there's a lot of been in the news, a lot of stuff going on. So let me set a context, and then I want you to fill in the details for our listeners. We hear all this stuff about executive orders. In our civics classes, you know, we hear about legislation. How does a bill become a law, et cetera, et cetera. And then we know there's a court system, et cetera. Well, what happens sometimes is that there is a certain amount of discretion that the president or the governor or mayor has in how you implement the law, how you kind of make it real, how you carry it out in real life. And sometimes what they do is they issue executive orders to say, well, here's how we're going to carry out the law. Now, again, I'm not going to get into the specifics. Jody's going to do that. And every now and then, in my words, presidents get a big head. And they kind of do executive orders that really go too far, and it goes beyond. And then sometimes the courts say, can't do that because you don't have that type of authority. And it happens both on the left and it happens on the right. So what's going on now is, could you tell our listeners, Jody, tell us about these executive orders that President Trump signed in the past week?
Sure. So you're right about the context that there's been executive orders, especially on immigration, from both the Obama administration and the Trump administration, and they've been controversial. So you may remember that even last summer, there was a lawsuit that went up to the Supreme Court about some of President Obama's executive actions. So President Trump signed an executive order on Friday, which did a couple of things. First, it's been called the Muslim ban, which is not exactly accurate, but it did ban the admission of any immigrants from any of the seven countries that were named in the executive order. It also put a ban on all refugees from any parts of the world coming into the United States. And what was most controversial, disturbing about these executive orders is that they were implemented immediately, which has caused a lot of chaos and confusion, both among immigrants and U.S. citizens, but also among the agencies that are tasked with carrying out or implementing these executive orders.
Jody, I'm going to make this real simplistic for our leader, for our listeners, and you tell me that I'm wrong. I'm making it too simplistic. When you said these executive orders were implemented and they went into effect immediately, let me use a silly analogy, okay? It's almost like, I think, if a teenager went out on a date and went out at 6 o'clock, and then the parent said, your curfew is 6 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they already are out. It's not like they say, well, next week your curfew is going to be 6 o'clock. It's like, well, it is now, but you're already out. Is my analogy a little bit off or what?
No, I think your analogy is correct, that these were usually the way that all directives, whether they be laws or orders, are given a time period in which they will be implemented so that people can plan for that, can prepare for that, can possibly challenge that, and so that the agencies themselves have time to delve into the nuances of this. This was implemented. There were literally people on airplanes coming to the United States when this executive order was signed that were affected when they landed and were turned away at the airports. This is also controversial because the executive order seemed to implicate any immigrant, including lawful permanent residents. But I also emphasize that, you know, immigrants arriving by plane, all of them have some sort of lawful status, either a visa, refugee status, a student visa, some permission to come to the United States.
Well, Jody, if we're speaking with Jody Zisma, who is a supervising attorney for Catholic Charities, and we're speaking about the recent executive orders and the impact that they have had. You know, what you just said, Jody, is that people get on a plane, they have some type of visa or documentation which says actually they can get off the plane. Because I know when I go on a plane, and I don't do it often, but travel internationally, they check to make sure that I have the right thing so I can get off the plane. And I know because, you know, I've been in line and sometimes they've pulled people offline and they say, oh, no, you don't have the right, you have to go there, et cetera, et cetera. So to a certain extent, they did a little bit of checking, and these people were authorized, at least when they got on the plane, to enter into the United States.
Absolutely. And it's more than just a little bit of checking. These people went through an application process. Many of them did both in-person interviews and extensive background checks conducted by the U.S. government, you know, international security checks, national security checks. Many of them paid money and went through a process and were approved. And then the president issued an order basically not honoring our own laws and prejudicing the people who had gone through this process, done it correctly, and with the expectation that they would be allowed to get off the plane and use their visas to enter the United States.
Jody, now let's move down to the practical level. One of the things that Catholic Charities does throughout the country and what we do in New York is within the framework of the law, we have attorneys and we have paralegals, we have counselors who basically advise people how to abide by the immigration law, by the refugee resettlement law, to make sure that they a plot that they that they're within it. And so what we at Catholic Charities sent some of the attorneys that you supervise to the airport to make sure that people, you know, could abide by the law and they could have their rights protected. Give our listeners a little sense. What did people find when they got to the airport?
So we went to the airport. My team went over the weekend. I went on Monday and spent all day at JFK Airport. There was a team of volunteers that volunteer attorneys, volunteer translators, volunteer paralegals who are there to monitor the situation and to really figure out what is going on. There's a lot of chaos and confusion. I spoke with some people at Customs and Border Protection who seemed to be unclear about what they were tasked with doing because there's an executive order that is still being vetted by the heads of these agencies. There's also been some court decisions which affect parts of the executive order. So there's a lot of confusion. So we were at the airport talking with families waiting for their relatives to arrive. We talked with some people who had actually been admitted. And it seemed to be that, you know, there's a lot of different stories, a lot of things that are happening. We did hear stories about people being turned away, not being admitted, students who were coming back after their winter break, expecting to start their semester, having valid student visas, who were turned away and essentially deported at the airport. We talked to a number of lawful permanent residents, green card holders, who had been interrogated and essentially detained for 5-6 hours before they were admitted to the United States. We also heard stories of people not being allowed onto planes to fly to the United States because of this order.
Now, Jody, so we also heard, and I talked a little bit about, that there was a court case and people did go to court, and at least part of the executive order was said, wait a minute, we want to know what's going on here. For the time being, stop. You can't implement this part of it. And in February, we'll kind of look into the whole thing to see what's going on. What did that court, what did the judge say in that situation?
Well, there's been a number of lawsuits, particularly what's called habeas corpus petitions, which are for people who either we don't know where they are, or we know that they're being detained, basically forcing the government to explain why these people are being detained. So there was a lawsuit in the Eastern District Court of New York, but there's been lawsuits throughout the country about the same issues, people arriving at airports, not being allowed in. So that executive order, or that court order, basically said, yes, let's put a pause on this. Let's not deport people until we can figure out what's going on. It doesn't allow people to be released necessarily. It just should prevent them from being deported. We have heard that court order is being honored in some places and not in others. It's very difficult for us as lawyers on the ground to find out who is being turned away at the border because by the very situation, they're not being allowed in. So they're not allowed to talk to attorneys. They're not allowed to explain what is happening. Likewise, it's very hard to determine who is being detained. And that is one thing the judge asked for, is a list of who is actually being placed into immigration detention.
Now, so again, for our listeners' sake, so somebody comes into the country, somebody gets off a plane, and, you know, when you go into the country, you almost have to do two things, don't you? You have to make sure you're not bringing in any bad stuff,
yep,
which is kind of like customs and taxes and stuff like that. And then you got to go to make sure you're okay to come in. So in this case, when somebody got to the airport from one of these countries, they basically said to them, you can't come in?
So you're right that there's both a customs check, which is for the goods that you're bringing in,
right,
and also an immigration check. They're both operated by the same entity. It's Customs and Border Protection, CBP. And my understanding is that when people come in, they are, I do know that everyone is fingerprinted when they come to the United States now. Everyone has their passports scanned, their visas checked, their green cards checked, and they usually do, just like we do when we go into another country, a couple minute interview about where they came from, making sure their documents are valid, making sure there's nothing suspicious. I believe what is happening is that those interviews are being prolonged for people that are from these seven countries. And we have heard rumors that even people from other countries are also being interrogated. And then if they have visas, that they are being canceled and that the people are being put back on planes to where they came from.
But supposedly, because the executive order, because of the judge's order, they can be detained, but they're not supposed to be put back on planes, correct?
Right. So the judge's order is really just for New York.
Okay.
And like I said, there's it's a little bit hard to know the reality, but it seems to be that is being honored in New York. Although the problem now that we're having is that people are not being allowed on planes. Right. So there's people that will be subjected to this ban are not actually arriving in the United States anymore.
So, and again, the at least one of the ways I saw it reported over the weekend was that even though it was a decision by a New York-based court, that it did apply nationwide. But yes. I don't know whether that
I
is
think
true.
That that is true, but there's been a lot of confusion. And of course, this is all happening in a very short time frame.
Right.
And to communicate all of these different changes to each official that is interviewing people and is inspecting people when they come in is a very challenging thing to do.
Jody, as far as you know, was there kind of an immediate like report of a threat from a terrorist attack from one of these countries that really forced this precipitous action and impetuous kind of issuing? Was there some threat?
No, I believe that this was just a campaign promise that President Trump seemed to have made or thought he had made, and that the action, like you said, was impetuous, that this should have been done through a congressional process, through a law. And I think a lot of the controversy would have been weeded out in that process, that we wouldn't have been doing things that were an abrogation of our own immigration laws, and that could have been done in a manner that was less discriminatory or at least more rational. And again, we didn't do this kind of, we've never had a blanket ban on any nationality, not even after 9/11, not even after some of the, you know, Pearl Harbor attack or any of the other attacks on our country.
Now, I've heard it said, and which is a little not legal, but I've heard it said that ironically, weren't some of the terrorists or most of the terrorists for 9/11 from Saudi Arabia?
Yes.
And Saudi Arabia wasn't on the list.
It seems to be an arbitrary list that It doesn't seem to have any rational connection to actual terrorist activities or where the threats are actually coming from.
And again, I think one of the things that a court case does is basically kind of try to sort a lot of different things out. So, you know, obviously, the administration that issues the order say, "Oh no, it's not a Muslim ban. It's whatever. It's something different." But the court says, "Hey, wait a minute. You know, if it smells like a rose, if it tastes like a rose, you know, all of those things, it may well be that. Even if you just can't make up what you want it to be, we're going to look at what it actually is."
That's correct, and that's actually Supreme Court precedent going back more than 100 years looks at what are the prejudicial effects of such a law. Usually it pertains to a law, not necessarily executive order. But I think that this is not usually the posture of an action taken by the U.S. government. Usually, and I think that a lot of, you know, as I mentioned, I think a lot of the discriminatory effects, a lot of the legalities should have been vetted before. Now we're forcing the courts to do this after the fact, while this is being implemented, which is a much messier situation than had it been done before and some of these things checked out before it was implemented.
Jody Zeesma, thank you so much for being with us. It was very informative to me. I hope it was informative to our listeners. We'll talk a little bit more about this later on in the show. But it certainly is something that is very, very troubling. It's very troubling, particularly from our, you know, Catholic beliefs in the dignity of the human person, our belief in the fact that we should be a welcoming and integrating country. So it is very difficult. Jody Zeesma, supervising attorney for Catholic Charities in New York, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. And this is an incredibly difficult, it's an incredibly anguishing time for Catholic Charities, for the Catholic Church, for our country, because we're at the center of what's going on in the country, and it's so anguishing for immigrants and refugees who are right now really in a terribly difficult situation. A lot has been happening in the public square. Spontaneous protests about the executive orders that President Trump has issued. There was also a women's march dealing with issues, women's issues. There was a pro-life march. And so there has been a lot of civic activity on what is going on. And at the center of it is the Catholic Church and also is Catholic Charities. And particularly appropriate because this is the 100th anniversary of Catholic Charities in New York, not only New York City, but New York State. And we kicked that off last Sunday with Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral and a luncheon for some of the people around New York who we wanted to make sure they knew that we wanted to be partners with them in building a better New York. Brooke, you got a clip from that luncheon? How about the second clip?
Since this diocese was established 209 years ago, the Diocese of New York, her bishops, her priests, her religious sisters and brothers, her deacons, and her people have worked hard to obey the mandate of the Bible to feed the hungry, to care for the widow and orphan, to shelter the homeless, to clothe the naked, to welcome the refugee, to teach our children in our excellent schools, especially those of the poor and the immigrant. Well, in 1917, the Archdiocese more professionally organized and better coordinated this dazzling array of apostolates under Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York. Since then, we've invested a lot of sweat, muscle, heart, brain, soul, and wallet into strengthening New York's families and our children, the key cell of any civil and enlightened culture. We've partnered with other religious, many here this afternoon, thank you, with civic and business and philanthropic groups, glad many of you are here with us this afternoon, and with appropriate agencies of our city, state, boroughs, counties, and federal jurisdictions, and I'm sure glad to see all of you here this afternoon.
Well, that was our leadership kickoff luncheon, and it was a wonderful luncheon following Mass in which we gathered a lot of leaders around to talk about what we're going to do together to make our city and our region more compassionate. And it's going on in every part of the country because there are Catholic charities in every neighborhood, every community throughout the United States doing good and providing help, creating hope for people. I want to continue the theme of immigration, and because Cardinal Dolan spoke about the fact that for us, we believe in the dignity of the human person. That's what's critical for us. Brooke, could you play the fourth clip there about when he talked an example about what that means for Catholic Charities?
About 6 years ago, in a city far south of here, state troopers raided a Catholic charity soup kitchen, which they claimed was in defiance of a new state law, soon after negated, by the way, that forbade any charitable help to undocumented immigrants. Look, officer, the priest from Catholic Charities who ran the kitchen said, you're welcome. Sit down and have a bowl of soup and a chunk of bread and a glass of iced tea, but it's really none of your business whom we serve. We don't ask to see baptismal certificates, driver's licenses, passports, or green cards. All we care about is that the folks who come here are God's children, a person whose stomach is growling and whose heart is troubled and lonely. And the police left.
That was Cardinal Dolan at our leadership luncheon speaking about the fact that Catholic Charities programs will serve people of all ethnicities, will serve people of all religions, and will serve people regardless of whether or not they have the proper papers. If they're hungry, we'll feed them. If they need some support, we'll provide some support for them. I would like to, because it is such a difficult and a challenging issue, I'm going to just take a few moments of your time to read you something that Cardinal Dolan wrote that was in the newspaper this past week. And so I'm going to just read straight through what Cardinal Dolan wrote. Recently, over an enjoyable meal, a rabbi friend and I discussed at length a litany of controversial topics, from immigration to the death penalty, minimum wage to abortion, from prison reform to physician-assisted suicide. We agreed on some, we differed on others. At the end of our pleasant conversation, my colleague teased me, and he said, "The trouble with you is that you're so damn consistent." Well, I take that as a compliment. Our belief in the dignity of the human person, the sanctity of human life, a conviction the rabbi and I share, leads to what we Catholics call a consistent ethic of life. What Pope St. John Paul II called a culture of life. What Pope Francis refers to as an ecology of inclusion and protection for the most vulnerable. This leads us to affirm the civil rights of the innocent baby in the womb, to oppose the death penalty, to advocate for both the vulnerable refugee and the struggling laborer. This consistently is hardly unique to us as Catholics, but characterizes the values of people of many religions, or none at all. It's a bedrock principle of this great republic, founded upon certain self-evident inalienable rights. Recently, we've been let down by our national and state executives. President Trump's impetuous and terribly unfair executive order, closing the historically open door of America to certain immigrants just because of their country of origin, cheapens their human dignity, and in many cases, places their lives and future in danger. It is contrary to the teachings of the Bible Christians and Jews cherish, and at odds with the celebrated reputation for hospitality the nation we love enjoys. Even my brother Archbishop Bashwadu of Erbil, Iraq, who was coming for a visit this week as my guest to advocate on behalf of his suffering people in Iraq, is now closed out. Protecting our borders and strengthening background checks? Fair enough. Blanket refusal to allow immigrants from a given nation, ethnic, or religious group? No way. Governor Cuomo's recent proposed radical extension of an abortion license in this state, already the most extreme in the nation, advocating the rights to abortion at any stage of the 9-month stay of the baby in the womb, is a cause for concern to 74% of Americans, who, according to the Marist poll of last week, feel abortion needs prudent restrictions. His insistence that we all pay for those abortions is only more upsetting. Strange. Last week, Trump showed admirable solicitude for the innocent baby in the womb with a series of benevolent executive order. Then he displayed callousness to another group who are also frail and fragile and vulnerable, the immigrants and refugees. Strange. Cuomo has long been a leader in advocating for the rights of refugees, so appropriate for an American, especially a New Yorker, where we daily see the gift that immigrants are. Then he advances laws to invade the most fundamental and natural sanctuary of them all, the womb cradling an unborn baby. As usual, Pope Francis hit the nail on the head with his prophetic words to Congress during his pastoral visit to the United States in 2015. He reminded us that the world is facing a refugee crisis of magnitude not seen since World War II, and that we must respond in a way that is always humane, just, and fraternal. We need to avoid a common temptation nowadays to discard whatever proves troublesome. Let us remember the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. This rule points us in a clear direction. In a word, if we want security, let us give security. If we want life, let us give life. If we want opportunities, let us provide opportunities. The yardstick we use for others will be the yardstick which time will use for us. The golden rule also reminds us of our responsibility to protect and defend human life at every stage of its development. Thanks, Mr. President, for your concern for the baby in the womb. Can you show the same for the threatened immigrant? Thanks, Mr. Governor, for your eloquent defense of the immigrant welcomed by Lady Liberty at the door to the state you govern. Can you show the same solicitude for the infant awaiting birth? Some consistently, please. Cardinal Dolan, Archbishop of New York, in the newspaper last week. Let's go to a break. We'll be back in just 2 minutes on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. You know, we're speaking this week about some of the issues that are really at the center of the debate in the public square, and some of the debate is not terribly pleasant because it deals with issues in which our country has come to the point where there are a number of things going on that are really terribly troubling to us based upon our Catholic prism of the dignity of the human person, the protection of human rights, that there are things going on that are really disturbing to us. So we're calling attention to them this week so that hopefully we can learn a little bit more about them and raise our voice for the sake of justice, and the sake of reconciliation, the sake of a better country in which we all live. It's my privilege now to speak with Christian Hawkins, who is the president of Students for Life of America. And I particularly am delighted that Christian has taken the time to be with us, because we talked about earlier in the show that there were two marches in the recent weeks, the Women's March on Washington and the annual Right to Life March in Washington, taking place within 7 days of each other. And Christian Hawkins was a participant in both. She marched in both of those. And I think that is a very, very interesting and important perspective for our listeners to understand and hear about. So, Christian Hawkins, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love today.
Thank you so much for having me, Monsignor.
Okay, so I'm just delighted that you are with us. Give our listeners a little bit of sense of your own biography. Where'd you kind of hang out for the first few years of your life, and what'd you do after that, and where'd you go to school?
Sure. Well, I grew up in West Virginia, near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Now, I always want to know about West Virginia. Were you in the fat part of the state or the skinny part of the state?
I was in the very skinny part, the very northernmost tip.
So that's the one, if you blink, you're in Ohio, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Right, okay.
I lived about 2 miles from the Pennsylvania border and about 5 miles from the Ohio border.
Like I said, you know, you blink, and 8 miles, you go through three states. But
that's
anyway.
That's exactly right.
All right, so anyway, Christian, please, go ahead.
And that explains why I don't have as much of a southern draw as my friends and relatives from the rest of the state.
Okay.
We're above the Mason-Dixon line.
All right, okay, good.
I was a Yankee. So I grew up there in West Virginia. I got involved in the pro-life movement when I was 15. I started volunteering at a pregnancy resource center in Steubenville, Ohio. And that's really where I fell in love with the pro-life movement. And from there, I started a pro-life group in my high school. I went to college nearby, Bethany College. I got a full ride to that school, and I started a pro-life group there. I originally wanted to become an aeronautical engineer, and then I discovered the pro-life movement, and then I discovered the injustice of abortion, and I decided to, you know, redirect the focus of my life and what I wanted to do with my life. And so that's really how I got passionate about this issue of ending abortion in our country. And so from college, I actually got involved in politics. I moved to Washington, D.C. after I graduated, and I worked there in the political world for about a year, year and a half. And then we launched Students for Life of America, and I was in D.C. for 10 years while we launched our organization, and I moved up here. I live in Minnesota now, so I've been living in Minnesota for about 2 years with my family while still running the organization. We're still headquartered there in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, but we've got about 33 staffers, and the vast majority of us are actually spread out across the United States.
So, Christian, but it's okay for aeronautical engineers to be pro-life, isn't it?
It's definitely okay for aeronautical.
Okay,
I just didn't want
our listeners to think that there was kind of a conflict between being an aeronautical engineer and being pro-life.
No, no, there's definitely, and that's one of the things we talk to our students about, our student leaders. We've got about 1,100 groups in, you know, every state of the country, and you know, we realize that not everyone's going to grow up and work full time in the pro-life movement, and that's okay. But we need pro-lifers spread out in every, you know, field, every job across this country. No matter where you're at, you can be a pro-life activist.
So, Christian, let's go. I mean, I assume you've participated in more than one pro-life movement, pro-life march in Washington.
Sure.
Anything different this year? What was your sense of this year's march? Any characteristics of it that may be a little different than in the past?
Well, there was a few differences. One, this year's march was huge. There was people everywhere. People were crowding the streets. The march went on and on and on for hours.
Larger than a number of years in the past?
Yes, larger than years in the past. You know, this year it had been moved down to the Washington Monument, which made for a really great rallying site right across from the White House. And it was a fantastic backdrop, made the march a little bit longer, but it was so great. Vice President of the United States join us, that was the first time we ever had a sitting president or vice president at the March for Life.
Now, I've said this myself, and I'll say it again. I've said it on the radio show. I think some of the policies of the vice president in with regard to the life issues are right on target. I'm a little upset with him that he had to kind of say he couldn't find Jesus in the Catholic Church and he had to leave the Catholic Church to find Jesus someplace else. That doesn't make him one of my favorite people, but on this issue, he's on the right side of this issue.
He's definitely on the right side of this issue. And one of the things I love about the vice president, I've worked with him for several years when he was a congressman in Washington. He and his wife got into politics because they were pro-life to end abortion. Yeah. And a lot of times we have pro-life politicians who are in Washington, but most of the time they've gotten into politics for another reason, where he's somebody who he got into politics to help us end abortion. And so he's somebody that I had the honor of meeting with him on Thursday night before the march. He had a special reception for us and a few other pro-life leaders there at the White House. And it was so great to see him in this new role and to see just where God is leading him. Of course, we're sad that he has fallen away from his Catholic faith. But he's going to make an incredible ally for us in Washington.
Yeah, I wish he'd get a little bit more concern for refugees because he was not too helpful when he was governor of Indiana on that issue and tried to stop refugees from coming into that state. It's a weeds and wheat situation where, you know, people could do a little bit more consistent on some of those issues. But the one thing I have to say, I did listen to his talk on the pro-life at the rally. I thought he spoke with an absolute sense of the words he used. I was very, very pleased by the words of compassion, the words of kind of reconciliation. They weren't harsh words. They were words of bringing people together. And I just think that is so much needs to be done if we're going to kind of move the needle on getting our nation to be much more pro-life consistently. He didn't use, at least in what I heard, he didn't use any rhetoric that was divisive or that divided us from each other.
No, he didn't, and he is, what he said is what's on his heart. He's very good at what's saying on his heart and what he believes, and so I was very moved by what he said at the March for Life, and just to see the clarion call he made. It was a stark difference from the rhetoric and the language that was used at the Women's March in D.C. just, 6 days earlier. You know, we were there at the Women's March, and just to see the vile things that were said, the hateful things that were said, the divisive things that were said on that stage, I mean, it was a stark difference from the March for Life.
So tell our listeners, we're speaking with Christian Hawkins, who is the president of Students for Life America, and she was actually at both the Women's March and the Pro-Life March. So tell us a little bit about the Women's March. Why'd you go to the Women's March? And I think, again, I would say, I think some of our listeners know that there was, you know, there wasn't a great welcome in the Women's March for pro-life women to participate in that. But you went, and I'm glad you went.
Yeah, no, there definitely, we weren't welcome there. We knew when it was being organized right after the election that it was going to be an anti-Trump march. But you know what? We asked them to partner anyway. They had sent out an all call online, and had asked people to, you know, people of diverse backgrounds to sponsor the Women's March. And so I actually had reached out to them pretty early on and said, you know, I would love to partner with you guys on this, and we'd love to be able to help with this. But we never heard any response back. Some of my friends who lead other pro-life organizations, where their name isn't so, you know, pro-life sounding,
right,
they had applied for partnership status. And then when an Atlantic article came out about how we were going to be there, all of those groups got quickly taken off and removed. You know, the point for us for being there, why I wanted to be there, was, you know, regardless of how you felt about the president and the presidential election, this is an important issue to discuss. The issue of abortion is the human rights issue of our day, and it's a women's issue. But sadly, in our country, you can't talk about women's rights without having to talk about abortion. The abortion lobby has been very good about buying off any discussion. And if, in fact, you know, if you're a pro-life woman, you're not even welcome at the table. We do events on college campuses all the time about bringing tangible support services to campuses, you know, diaper changing stations in the bathrooms, lactation rooms, scholarships for pregnant and parenting students, housing for pregnant and parenting students. And we have these discussions on campuses. Our groups, our student life groups, will invite the pro-abortion group on campus, and guess who never shows up? The pro-abortion group, because they refuse to have any discussion about helping women choose life unless you're in agreement with them on abortion.
You know, Christian, but I would have to say that I completely agree that we have moved to the point of such a political correctness in this world that you can't talk about certain issues in certain circles without being completely ostracized. And I have always been a big fan of the approach that Cardinal Dolan has always taken. He has basically said, you know, if we talk to somebody, it doesn't mean we're endorsing what they say. It means we're engaging them because we want to them to understand what our values are, what I position. But unfortunately, there are a lot of people in this country who, if you disagree with them, and particularly on the pro-life issues, they don't really want to have any conversation with you. And it's another indication of how divided we've become, you know, as a nation.
That's exactly right. And that's something that, you know, if we're ever going to end abortion in our lifetime, we need people from all different walks of life, you know, all different political ideologies on board. And we need to be able to have these hard discussions. And I think that's what's so remarkable and what was, you know, so trustworthy about, you know, the Women's March not allowing pro-life women to be there. Because they simply just did not allow us to be a part of the conversation. So we went there anyway. We passed out abortion betrays women signs. For, you know, when the march started going down Constitution, we actually jumped in front of the march and led the march for several blocks past the White House until the marchers found out we were pro-life. And then things started to get a little testy, and people tried to rip the signs out of our hands. I had moms and dads with strollers trying to use their child's stroller to block our banners. I had women who, my mom's age and older, trying to stop our banners. I mean, really, you could just see the hurt. There's so much hurt and desperation in the eyes of those people who were there. And that's really what I think one of the biggest, the most stark difference between the two marches for people who were there. If you looked at the rhetoric, if you looked at the signs that were held at the Women's March versus the March for Life, there was just like this hopelessness and despair at the Women's March. It was angry. It was mean. It was hopeless. Or even in Washington, even in years where we had a pro-abortion president where we knew we wouldn't pass any life-saving legislation, where we knew we'd be funding these abortion giants with our taxpayer dollars, there was always a sort of hope. There was always a sort of respectfulness for the institution that you just didn't see at the Women's March. And I think it's very sad. It's a very sad thing when you look at how many wounded people we truly have in our country today.
Christian Hawkins, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love, but thank you even more for the leadership. And it's not easy to kind of stand out there. It's not easy to engage people who really oftentimes show disrespect for those with whom they disagree with. And so thank you so much for what you're doing, what your colleagues are doing to make sure that that human life is put front and center in the issues of this country. So, Christian Hawkins, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Join us again next week on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Thank you for being with us. Sirius XM, the Catholic Channel, 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.